You are listening to National Security Law Today.
I'm Elisa Poteet, and welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. It's a new year, of course, and there's a lot to watch when it comes to national security law in 2025. But before we jump into the new year, we're also going to look back at the old. And to help me with that, I'm joined by friend of the cast, man about town, polymath Harvey Ryshikov, also known as the former chair of Skolins. Hi, Harvey.
Hey, Elisa, how you doing?
Well, I am doing well. I hope 2024 has been super kind to you and yours, and I hope you're looking forward to 2025.
Yes, and let me begin on behalf of the committee to thank you for all the work you've done in 2024, 2023, 2022, and how you've made the podcast one of the jewels in the crown of the Standing Committee, sort of offers that we give to this lovely Standing Committee on Law and National Security. So I want to officially be on record to thank you.
I appreciate
all that you do and all the sacrifices you make for our podcast.
Thank you, Harvey. And you know, you make a lot of sacrifices too, because you help me often.
I know, but you know, I still take polygraphs. So what I'm saying has to be true, Elisa.
Okay, well, let's just jump into the last year. I would say that it has been an exceedingly eventful year. You know, there are three hot wars going on. We appear to be in times of hegemonic upheaval. There's been a change because of an election. We're going to have a change in administration. And I think many Americans were wondering if the United States will continue to retain its significant national security status. So I wanted to ask you first, what would you say were the top three national security law news items? We'll break this into two parts. The top three news items from 2024.
So I would say the first item, which is a carryover from double Trump one and then Biden and Trump two, is the carryover has been the use of executive orders by the president to help regulate a whole range of critical issues. The use of the IEEPA, as you know, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, and the use of the concept of there being a National Emergency Act. So I'd say during this period over the last 4 years, the effective use of executive orders, particularly in the cyber area, have been quite outstanding as one sort of outstanding element. I would say the other element, which is still going on, is the issue of what to do with the First Amendment and the TikTok ban. As you know, that has just been recently entered by the president-elect, who filed an amicus brief in order and requesting the court to delay its decision affirming or reversing the Court of Appeals. And there I would add that was kind of intriguing in the application, which a lot of press have focused on because the language of the document is somewhat over the top vis-a-vis the president's ability to negotiate. But what I found the most interesting actually was part of the attack on the Congress in that the act was overstepping its power under Article 2 in foreign affairs. If the court does pick up and is going to have oral argument later this month in January before the inauguration, how the court deals with not only the First Amendment issues and there's an interesting question dealing with, for those of us in the law geeks, what's the appropriate standard of review, whether or not it should be sort of a rational basis or strict scrutiny, which is a large part of the opinion. But this issue of whether or not it is appropriate for the Congress to be legislating this area, given the foreign policy, foreign affairs aspect that the case raises. Third issue that has been fascinating has been sort of the emergence of the plutocracy, the role of the billionaires, and how the billionaires across not only Silicon Valley, but also in the power of economic construction, how they have shaped this year's concept of what it means in the competition that we have with our main peer adversary, China, and the role of China and how it dominated sort of so many aspects of national security law, It's another sort of major aspect of 2024.
So there's going to be some overlap with mine too, but I want to jump back for just a second to the filing of the TikTok amicus brief. As we've learned, and our listeners have learned from some of our recent podcasts, the individual who filed the brief, John Sauer, I believe is his name, is hoping to become the Solicitor General, but no nominations have occurred yet because nominations can only occur when the president is sitting as president. I mean, the only thing that, I guess a couple things stood out to me, I've never seen language so colloquial as was in this brief, including sort of parenthetical asides that were in colloquial language, a request on a behalf of an individual who is elected to stop something as if he were sitting in his office. Practical concerns aside, that there may be an ultimate issue of some mootness for the court if the president-elect, once inaugurated and once in office, then changes his mind about this order, which he will be probably privileged to do. And then with respect to the idea of Congress overstepping, one thing that always shocks me, and I guess it would shock some of our listeners, is that many of these decisions are based on extensive review of classified information. And that information is not available to everybody in Congress who might be a stakeholder slash decision maker here. Many of them don't even have security clearances. It's interesting that he would like to see this managed in a different part of the government and when they would not necessarily have access to the same information, the same fact basis, and the same knowledge that an individual with an appropriate level security clearance functioning in the executive branch would have. I think one interesting thing is no sooner did this happen, and the accusation, of course, is that underpinning this is the opportunity for China to use TikTok for its cognitive warfare purposes to, you know, sour Americans on their own country and extend their influence, then Treasury Department was hacked by China. And, you know, they've made it public that China government actors were behind the attack. Now, it apparently didn't get declassified information. But nevertheless, when confronted and asked about this, a spokesperson for, you know, the Chinese foreign government did not deny it, but instead said that China in general was against hacking.
Well, let me take your points in order. The first on the amicus. As a law professor reading the brief, I would say the writing style and repetitiveness was somewhere in the B range. It would have, I think, been benefited from severe editing in order to make the points that the practitioner wanted. Two, the interesting question also raised in the amicus was the suspicion of any government actually evidence placed before the court. It ends with an allusion to the famous 51 members of the intelligence community who wrote the letter concerning Biden's laptop. And the illusion is that, therefore, these individuals are more politically motivated than motivated by facts.
And that's also sort of intriguing, right?
For them to put that in the amicus and then alluded to another incident of where the government is considered to be suspicious as far as the writer of the amicus is. I had not really seen that before. Two, on that point, it is complicated because one of the reasons for the revolution was the Court of Star Chamber, which had secret evidence at the parliamentary side. So I think the government, when it does have evidence that is, quote, secret and they're worried about sources and methods concerning TikTok, there may be some requirement for this to be placed before the court in camera and some declassified summary of that evidence to help justify the decision by the court. And thirdly, I would end that I do find the D.C. Court of Appeals opinion a little bit intellectually underwhelming, that the analysis that the court makes in the First Amendment range and the government's sense of its fear of TikTok because of the amount of data that it holds on individuals and the potential manipulation of the data that it uses as an example. Unfortunately, as a logic, I think pertains to many large social media platforms.
But there are social media platforms. Right? I think that's generally it, right? People are like, Facebook does this.
Well, which may imply that in 2025, there'll be much more willingness on the Congress's part to regulate the social media that many of us are calling for.
I take your point. And I know when I spoke to Glenn Gerstle a couple of weeks ago, we discussed the same thing that, you know, the point is social media is not just an entertainment source, right? You are the product. Everything that you do, hover on, look at, is sold to data aggregators. God knows where these people send that data. It's a loosely regulated, if at all, industry. And, you know, there are spurious types that are involved in these data aggregating, internet advertising businesses, and they could be easily selling it to Russia or anybody for the purpose of ascertaining things like how to neutralize us as a unified and powerful country through cognitive warfare and the deployment of false messages across social media. But they've already done that.
Well, also it reminds me of the old chestnut debate about what false consciousness is and cognitive security in a democratic process. So that always is the great enigma that individuals seem not to fully understand what their own self-interest is and seem to vote against their self-interests, which seems to be for many, if you remember the old debate, that if the working class only would understand its real interests, it would stop voting X. But for some reason, it continues to vote X.
Yes. Excellent point. Or I thought what you were going to do is quote Churchill, who said something along the lines of best way to talk yourself out of a democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter.
And then, as you know, we sort of focused on domestic trends, but internationally, of course, one has to focus on how technology is revolutionizing how we actually project force. I think the conflicts both in Ukraine and the conflict in Gaza have been revolutions in the use of force, whether it's the willingness of the Israelis to use the level of force that they're using in Gaza, which they believe is not a violation of the law of armed conflict, and also the response by the international community to that force, and then the extraordinary use of drones in Ukraine that are helping to revolutionize what we thought in classic ways of projection force, and how tanks have become seem to be less significant given this new technology. It's another 2024 event of evolution that I can see only getting stronger in 2025.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it just, I mean, I was a wild fan of science fiction, Star Wars, Star Trek, anything I could get my hands on when I was a kid. But you'll remember that most of that predicted a drone force would eventually replace all this cumbersome hardware.
Well, and as I say, when I'm no longer asked to speak to the Air Force general officers, because I usually stand in front of them, explain to them that PILOT is an acronym for personnel in lieu of technology. And they get very upset with that, the fighter pilots.
So did Tom Cruise.
Yeah, well, I think
Top
yes.
Gun.
Yes, these movies are like of the past. It's like watching lords on top of horses and steeds and fighting knights.
Hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. I think we're very much on the same page here in terms of what we think were the major national security events for 2024. Sort of one angle of what you've already raised is I do think the executive order that prevents the bulk transfer of U.S. persons' data to countries of concern, I think presents a threat to the business model of big tech. I think it's because they know very well that they don't have any control over where this data goes once it's spun into the data aggregation cycle. And to use that euphemism that they often do, anonymize. It may be anonymized as to an individual, but as to a geographic region, as to interests, as to political leanings, it's very clear. The data paints a very specific picture. If it can figure out which size electric vehicle and color you might be interested in buying, it knows very much a lot more about your preferences and maybe even your political interests. So I do think that bulk order, which could easily be reversed, I think that that is probably one of the more significant changes. Again, that to your point, that occurred under an IEPA authority, and it was in the interest of national security. And it was part of, I guess there's this sort of free-flowing, digital, ongoing national security emergency, because that is obviously the predicate necessary for these orders to flow from IEPA. I mean, if you look at how many of them come flying out of, frankly, Trump's last administration and this one, then we should all be agitated and believe that we're in a, you know, never-ending cycle of ongoing emergencies. But I think that one was very important because I think our digital information now has a value that well exceeds things like gold bars and maybe in the order of things like our intellectual property that is so coveted by hostile foreign governments.
On that point, just to elevate it, in 24, obviously the last number of years, and increasingly we'll be approaching in 25, just the general concept of how we define privacy and what is appropriate for us to retain and what's appropriate for the state to have and what's appropriate for the corporate sector to have. Increasingly, as your comments point out, the corporate sector's understanding of they own privacy and they own your digital footprint and they own your sort of digital dust and what they do for a range of marketing purposes, and then authoritarian regimes, what they do that for their own national security reasons. And we just had the most recent example of the individual Luigi and his shooting of the executive from the healthcare. The speed with which he was found is really a demonstration of the amount of surveillance we have, even in the great democracy of New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
And also the extent to which individuals are online and networked, because, you know, it was often exchanges over things like social media accounts, even the ability to connect with law enforcement agencies in a moment through Twitter, not even by dialing 911, is, you know, just really amazing. And it's very futuristic. And the idea that you could mow somebody down on the streets of New York and not be captured by CCTV and every single move that you made is just amazing. But nobody thinks of everything. And apparently he didn't either. But the other thing was, I wanted to move on to generally the TikTok ban efforts. Again, I think it's important that whatever information they place before the court, it's going to have to also be, I think, social media specific, as opposed to China specific. Because over the years, multiple countries have spied on the United States, have attempted to exert foreign influence in one way or another. You would expect China to do some espionage. And, you know, we have intelligence services too. But I think what's going to be important is to show the risks specifically presented through ByteDance, maybe its officers, and the platform itself and its data usage. And I think they may have some of that because I believe there have been some email exchanges leaked wherein individuals inside TikTok admitted that the data that they had was already flowing to China in contravention of some of their public statements. So I agree with you on that. The last thing is you raised the issue of corporations. I think this is one of the most concerning developments, and we've seen it before. This is not the first time it's happened in the United States, but right now I just want to mention that there was a sudden, you know, conversation between Bezos, Zuckerberg, Elon Musk. They're all developers and purveyors of AI technology. And the Post is reporting that they have formed a consortium to try to lock down the $850 billion in Defense Department contracts. Once they do that, they won't just own our data, they will own our physical defense as well. And, you know, I just think to Harvey's point that this should cause alarm for Americans, and a lot of questions need to be asked. But with that level of power and with the need for Congress to pass the National Defense Authorization Act every single year, I think their potential to influence members of Congress has now exceeded something we've maybe never even seen in our history. I think this trend isn't exclusive to the United States. And I have seen also, Harvey, that in Japan, Nissan, Honda, and Mitsubishi Motors, for example, these are just three automotive companies, but they plan to complete a merger by 2026. And that would create the world's largest car maker and probably have an impact on U.S. automakers. It's just another example of companies like, for example, Mitsubishi isn't just into cars. They're into literally everything, almost all sectors of the economy. Mitsubishi has holdings. This is just an international trend where you're seeing these consolidations and the rise of power of these massive corporations. I don't know exactly what it means, but I know that the American people need to make their own self-governance decisions through the democratic process. And with, you know, super influential and wealthy companies able to donate to members of Congress who have to run for office for millions and millions of dollars every 2 years. I just don't think this is a healthy trend for America or national security. Harvey, what are you, is that sort of the direction you're seeing too?
So I would say that a number of trends. One, as you pointed out, the market system is moving to consolidation at macro levels. And that consolidation, again, that's why we created antitrust laws. The creation of these gigantic trusts that go across many, many sectors. And the issue that you also alluded to is this huge demand for energy, that in order to run the AI, in order to run these data centers, the amount of energy we need is going to be one of the great demands in the next 5 to 10 years. And that's why we're seeing things like a new interest in micro nuclear reactors in order to be able to handle that amount of power that's been required. And that's sort of across the board. But as you're saying, the consolidation inside the defense industrial base, it's not a secret that the defense industrial base is just not currently performing, that we have serious problems at DOD acquiring our platforms, and that the old 20th century way of acquiring armaments does not seem to be adequate. And B, as we move into more technological approaches in warfare, the DIB has to reform itself. And thirdly, as we've known for I don't know how many studies I've read and participated in, is that the acquisition process at DOD is just broken. So many of the critiques are not, how should I put it, fanciful. There are a number of critiques that are quite serious and require. And this idea that the solution may be the building of these extraordinary large trusts that involve a small number of businesses is something that I think all of us need to look at, and the Congress will have to look at very closely. So I think your concerns are legitimate, and we need to figure out what is the path forward in order for us to get on top of this. At the same time, being efficient enough to be able to rearm the Western states, given the conflicts that we are currently encountering.
Yes. And again, they are not manufacturing material at the speed necessary. I did see also on to that point that most of them have now increased to 2% of their GDP contribution or toward their defense, which is a requirement of NATO. There's not a pot somewhere. It's they're supposed to spend that.
I will tell
but
you.
But now he wants, Trump says, okay, you know what I said to what I really meant to say was 5.
No, but I think the other issue is, I'm embarrassed to say, but when we did navigating the national security enterprise for the DOD schools that I worked with Roger George on, at that edition, which is only about 3 or 4 years old, we did not even mention the concept of supply chain. And now there's no question that post-COVID demonstrated the need, but between cyber and supply chain, how vulnerable our production systems are. And that is a national security issue that you never would have heard raised, I would say, 3 years ago. And now it's at the top of everyone's sort of bucket list.
Well, I hope that this heralds not a corporate land grab so much as an opportunity for us to move forward in terms of our technology, the acquisition process. You mentioned the DIB, which is an acronym for the Defense Industrial Base, of course. And it's no secret that if you've read any books, this history of abuses in terms of the amount of money that defense contractors have asked for things and sort of some of the nonsense that has ensued over the years once escalated to a point where there was a seismic shift. And that, I believe that occurred sometime in the mid 80s is most recently. And so maybe we're due for one. I'd like to see, you know, I'd like to be the glass half full person here, and hopefully that can happen. But I think also your mention earlier on of drone warfare and sort of the way the world has changed from its kinetic engagement may suggest that bringing in American technology, which remains the best in the world in terms of cyber and AI and drone technology, is the best thing in terms of our national defense. But I think that one of the biggest stories right now that I am watching, and I believe began to become an issue this year and will certainly be an issue in 2025 if something doesn't turn around, is Right now in the United States in 2024, I think there are a lot of bad signs about the economy and where it could potentially go. We're also looking at a time when credit card defaults by Americans are at the same level they were right before the subprime crash, which occurred in 2009? And there are other economic indicators that are deeply concerning. But U.S. companies are also now defaulting at the fastest rate in 4 years. They're struggling to refinance after a wave of cheap borrowing. And when I hear cheap borrowing, I think of that cake mix of subprime mortgages that got mixed in with other investment instruments and almost collapsed the too big to fail banks and almost collapsed the U.S. economy. So there are a lot of things right now. There are some indication these things can turn around. But I think the United States, in order to develop all this technology that we're talking about, in order to bring down things like the deficit and, you know, the national debt, they are going to need the United States to have a very, very strong economy and a positive upward trajectory. And I think there are some indications right now that it might not be so great. And we maybe need to pay attention to that. So anyway, that gets to the question I wanted to ask you, which is, what are the three things that you are going to be watching, or the three sort of national security areas that you're going to be watching in 2025?
So the first is, I would say, I put it under the general topic of sort of science and technology. If you look at anyone's Christmas list in the space, everyone is talking about more or less 10 things. And those things are artificial intelligence and how we regulate it, both in the international, commercial, and military way, manner. Biotechnology and synthetic biology. I think there's a huge number of technological breakthroughs. We're very concerned about cryptology because of the potential advancement inside computer sciences. People are looking at material science and neuroscience, given the way we think about neurodiversity. We are, again, focused on nuclear technologies. I talked about the micro reactors, but also what to do. And then robotics, critical. We're going to continue with semiconductors. We passed the CHIP Act. It's unclear how the CHIP Act is being rolled out, whether or not it'll be effective. And then our favorite, the Captain Kirk role of the final frontier space, what's going on with Space Command and what's going on with our telecommunications. And then sustainable energy technologies. Those are sort of the areas in S&T that are going to have huge legal framework issues and also our competition phrase. The other areas that I think are going to be hybrid items is executive power. I think this administration is going to push executive power to its fullest. For those who are old enough to remember the minority report in Iran-Contra, I recommend it for your readings if we post it up. It made it very clear, penned by a number of individuals, including former Congressman Cheney, in which they articulate their belief in the power of the presidency and how it has been curtailed by previous generations. And when Bush 43 came in, this is the group that helped to push more expansive executive power. But I do want to end on a positive note, because, you know, I don't want to be the voice of doom. I want to give a shout out to the trial judge at Guantanamo, who reviewed the case in which the Secretary of Defense argued that he wanted to vitiate the plea deals that took place at 9/11. And it was a moment of courage. The trial judge did a very good analysis of why this, interestingly enough, would be controlled by contract law and not by what I would call tapping your shoulder, because I have more stars on my shoulder than you do. Mm-hmm. And just this week, the Court of Appeals and Judge Schenck, who's a former member of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, penned the appellate decision reaffirming the trial judge. So we actually may have a conclusion, at least with respect to these three litigants, for 9/11 in Guantanamo. And that would be a great gift to start 2025, to start the process of putting Guantanamo in our rearview mirror. So that to me is an extraordinarily positive issue. It is true, I'm somewhat close to it, but I'm trying to be as objective as possible that this is the correct way to go forward.
I have friends who are ultra conservative and friends who are extremely liberal, and they have both separately described Guantanamo to me as a festering wound that we need to address. And I thought it was interesting that they both use that precise verbiage. But let me throw out what I think are the kind of the big ones. I've already mentioned we need to watch the economy and protect it, obviously, the U.S. economy. In addition to everything that you've said on this sort of meta level, all of which I agree with, I'm also looking right now at the Middle East, which is a source, speaking on the topic of energy, of where a lot of the world's oil comes from and the largest reserves, maybe outside of the North Pole, which if it continues to thaw could replace the Middle East. But I think what we're watching right now is fascinating in terms of what has been revealed is Iran's actual strength as opposed to its perceived strength, as well as Russia's actual strength as opposed to its perceived strength. A weakened Hezbollah has found itself unable to provide assistance to Bashar al-Assad. Russia literally moved hundreds of thousands of people and troops out of Syria and gave up its only Mediterranean port, which was available to it because of the relationship that it had with the Assad regime. And I think at this point that there is a chance that Iran might find itself unable to hold on to its current structure and status internally and may have to make some reforms. Now, the only thing that could make that worse to them culturally, I think, is threats, which would make them dig in. It'll be interesting to see how a new administration deals with them, whether they're brought along back to, you know, some more recent century than the one they've been acting like they're living in, and whether they will recognize casting their lot with nearer to them than we are, Russia, maybe isn't the best choice. So I'm watching that with great interest. And there's so much that happens every single day that it's incredible to keep up with. It could wear you out.
What I think is fascinating is, for good or bad, the Israelis have changed the chessboard in the Middle East. And we're seeing the pieces now realigning. But what also has happened is, in my comparative youth, we used to talk about BRIC, Brazil, Russia, Iran, China. And now we can include other sort of authoritarian regimes.
Sure.
And there's a struggle going on to define what the international political order is. And these countries are opposed to our Western U.S.-dominated consensus. So coming up is going to be an extraordinary battle royale as to which of the two blocks will start to be dominant as they sort of vie each other. And it's now the common currency to refer to as we're in a competition phase, which can evolve periodically to a crisis phase, which then could evolve to a conflict phase, the three C's. And that clearly we have, the gloves are off with the competition. I think that the new administration will be even more aggressive on the competition with China. And then, as you're pointing out, how will that lead to more crises as we try to navigate those particular tensions? And I don't want to put you on the spot, but, you know, will there be more conflict in 2025 with more regions put into play on the chessboard is a question that we're all going to be quite, I'd say, watching closely.
Yeah, and I think we're watching a real crisis in one of our partners in South Korea right now, a political crisis. So you're right. I think that the chessboard is potentially changing. I like the way you put that about Israel. I'm always reluctant to say that anything has changed a situation for the good when so many individuals have died in that conflict. But I'm also watching China, and I just want to mention something that I think is of massive significance. And that is that China has now launched the world's largest amphibious assault ship at the Hudong shipyard in Shanghai. And they have also been flying new Chinese fighter jets around cities where China is developing a new stealth fighter technology. So they are certainly flexing their military muscle, and a competition could very easily escalate to a crisis and then ultimately a conflict. I do not personally understand where our technology is, but to your point, it's time to up our game, I would say. And then lastly, I do have a nomination for what I think is probably one of the most important books of the year, and it's not a national security book. Jonathan Haidt has written a book called The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Health. Now, he's a social scientist, and what he has observed is and been able to chronicle is children are now spending so much time on their cell phones that their academic performance has failed. In young childhood, there is a loss of play and a loss of real human interactions. This is causing a crisis because we are social creatures that cannot survive from birth without care. We need each other. We saw this in full flower during COVID when we had a lot of COVID crazies because people got isolated and really lost it. And I also took from his book that there is significant national security significance here because our great technology came from tinkerers, people who were curious. And what he is describing is a death of curiosity, play, and experimentation in the developing brain. Our next defense technology, our next great breakthrough in terms of any technology that betters mankind will come originally from somebody who tinkered, experimented, took risks, and played. And what he is saying is mass quantities and most kids aren't doing this anymore. And I think this is very significant. I think about 2 months after this book made it to whatever the New York Times bestseller list, a lot of school principals read it, and there became a pattern of schools for the first time actually preventing cell phones in schools. And the results were immediate, proving Haidt's theory. Play went up, conflict went down, fewer kids reported anxiety and depression, and the results were great. And so while these tech giants are moving to control the government, I have to remember that when he was developing the iPhone, Steve Jobs and other of these big CEOs took the people who had marketed cigarettes from the tobacco industry to try to determine ways to get people to spend more time with their phones. And I would like them to find another business model and free up the minds of our children for the sake of our future and our national security, as well as our happiness, which has always made this the best country in the world.
So I've been teaching, it's hard to imagine, since the 1970s. I was sort of, for some reason, accelerated in my teaching role.
Sounds very good right now, Harvey.
I would say that I just finished teaching this year. The level of fragility of these students is something that is unique and that I encountered.
Trigger warnings. And
I attribute that more to the COVID issue, COVID, that isolation. But I think in general, this notion of their relation to their tablets and what that means for the way they have a lack of resiliency that stands out in this particular cohort of students. And I think it is interesting, a number of nations that decided to ban cell phones in the classroom in order for the students to have to disengage from this thing that they're so tied to. And I have other professors who are telling them they have to take notes with a pen and paper because they've actually lost the ability to do cursive writing.
It's so worse than that. They're not teaching it in schools. Yeah. You know, I have a 14-year-old, and I can tell you that cursive was easier for him, but he wasn't taught it.
I find this sort of just, that's more of a societal sort of aspect that we're sort of dealing with. You know, it's across the board. It's one of those international sort of issues. But as you're saying, the book that sort of is effective is Harold Coe's book that talks about the evolution of executive power since World War II, that over time we have concentrated more and more power in the office of the presidency. And that
it was an outstanding book. I'm so glad you mentioned it. And we interviewed him on this podcast, and he was amazing. What a pleasure.
I would say, despite being from Yale, it's still extraordinary. But, you know, you do, even a blind squirrel finds a nut occasionally. But that the issue of how supine the Congress has become is, from a constitutional perspective, quite disturbing. And I think the composition of the Supreme Court and the deference it is showing to the executive and the opinions that it's come out in the last 2 or 3 years have also been quite disturbing vis-a-vis the almost reversal of the precedence of the Warren Court. So I think this is something that also institutionally is quite disturbing. And I'm glad you also mentioned the South Korea incident and what appears to be how authoritarianism and the right is on the move, where you look at Germany or you look at France, how Europe is moving to the right in a manner that's quite disturbing for many of us who believe that these countries are supposed to be the bulwark and first line of defense against Russia.
Well, I have so many theories about where some of this is coming from, and that could be an entire other podcast, but I'm really glad you came in tonight, and I wish you a happy new year before we close out. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners other than if you're under 30 and you're now looking up the word supine on your cell phone, put your cell phone down and go pick up an Oxford English Dictionary. It's useful for a lot of things.
But I just would say, I just want to end by thanking you that you've been a stalwart.
That's so sweet.
With this podcast. It's now sort of required listening for many of us. We're talking about the thousands of members of our extended family, the national security law community. And you're sort of been a core stalwart in this space. And thank you again for all that you've done. And of course, I think Holly's lurking in off stage somewhere, but I also would be.
Well, I was going to say, thank you for thanking me, but you know, really isn't the star of the show, Holly McMahon, the woman behind the scenes, who by the way, is wearing a Santa hat today. Yes. And anything but a serious expression. All right. Well, thank you so much. That was a lovely compliment and I appreciate it. I want to thank everybody for listening to NSLT. Don't forget to join us in the new year. Remember that what really helps us on NSLT is for you to rate our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or your listening app of choice. We thank you for doing that. It does heighten our exposure to other listeners. And it only takes about 2 minutes. Remember to share this episode with a friend or a colleague and discuss the issues that we have discussed thoughtfully, hearing other people's points of view. Remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country that is more diverse, not just in how we look in our ethnicity, but in our thoughts than any other country. Remember, we'll be back in 2025. And in late January, we will be bringing you a podcast series on the national security implications of our expanded need for energy, already raised right here by the ever brilliant Harvey Ryshikov. Our producer and writer and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer and the woman who really does everything behind the scenes. You never see her, you never hear from her, but she's back there juggling plates, looking things up on her phone, and otherwise keeping all of the members of the Standing Committee in line. But mostly I want to thank the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, because without them, this podcast would not be possible. We expect to see you in 2025 when the Standing Committee on Law and National Security will host many national security law events. You can find them on our website. You can get on our distribution list. Remember to come to one of the breakfasts or the symposia. You'll get to meet colleagues, new friends, and a thing or two, and you'll be glad you came. Happy New Year.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.